Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And we're here for the second reading podcast for the week of July 18th. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project here at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm joined by my colleague Josh Blank, who was up past his bedtime last night for the Democratic Convention.
And every night last week, and yeah, I'm dragging.
These conventions are hard on a family man.
It's hard.
So this week, the big political news is coming out of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, and we're going to talk about that. But before we get to Hillary Clinton's big moment, we want to close out the Republican National Convention in Cleveland last week, which was just getting underway as we did last week's podcast. And it was in Cleveland where, as expected, Donald Trump accepted the Republican presidential nomination and Ted Cruz. Well, he didn't. And he made some news by not endorsing Donald Trump. So we've got some audio, but let's start. So what do you make of the Ted Cruz thing, Josh?
Well, I mean, nobody expected Cruz to endorse Trump. So, I mean, my initial reaction, I was watching this live and I was texting with you because you were out and about and just sort of, I was giving you a play-by-play. And on the one hand, it was totally unsurprising because Cruz had at no point indicated that he was going to endorse Trump, right? But what was somewhat surprising was, you know, the reaction, because in a lot of ways, Cruz not endorsing Trump wasn't really news. It was the reaction in the hall to Cruz not endorsing Trump that made that such a big spectacle. And part of it was the fact that the New York delegation was front and center in the hall. And Cruz during the campaign had famously sort of derided Trump because of his New York values, right?
Right. And so he got, in that speech itself, some pushback, shall we say, from the New York delegation, which was seated front and center right in front of the stage.
Right.
And so we didn't excerpt the Cruz speech. It was pretty heavily excerpted, I think, from the, you know, from the perspective of Texas and the country, really, you know, Cruz really made a lot of headlines, took kind of a hit. And we'll talk about poll numbers maybe after we do the audio, I think.
Sure.
But the next morning, every morning at these conventions, and the political conventions are like a bunch of people that are really into politics hanging out.
They're a weird scene if you ever go to one.
Exactly. And so the state delegations, at least the big ones, they have a breakfast for their delegates. And so the local news outlets in Texas, or the big political ones anyway, have people taking video at these breakfasts that they have every morning. So the next morning, Cruz showed up at the Texas delegation breakfast, having been kind of the man of the moment. And kind of explained himself. So let's play a couple of excerpts from that Cruz visit to the Texas delegation breakfast.
I am watching and listening to make that decision. And when I talked about holding people accountable, I think that applies to all of us. That's what I'm doing. I am watching and listening. The election isn't today. And I am listening to the candidate. Now, what I don't intend to do is go out and throw rocks at Donald. I don't intend to criticize Donald. I intend, like a voter, like all of us, just to listen and make the best judgment I can. And every one of us, I think, has to follow our conscience. When friends of mine, when supporters of mine are asking what to do, the answer I give to everyone is follow your conscience. Do what you believe is right. Do what you believe defends your children and defends this country.
Yeah. Now, that came in response to a question from the audience. I'll give Cruz this. As he did his spoken piece, it was pretty clear, both from the night before and from that morning, that even in the Texas delegation, you know, opinion was divided. Not everybody was happy with him. And he'd gotten a question from the audience saying, you know, are you going to endorse? You should, you know, we all need to come together. And he echoed the conscience line that you thought was important from the night before.
Right. I mean, the line that really set everyone off. And it's, again, it's not a direct repudiation. It's not, I mean, he said basically, and I quote, To those listening, please don't stay home in November. Stand and speak and vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket who you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution. And basically right at that moment, that was when the hall erupted with boos. And but he's sticking to his guns. That's his position right now. The thing about for Cruz is, the response to this is, it's based on the context of sort of his political rise and his trajectory. And much of this was sort of seen as, he's invoking principle and, in the way that sort of Trump kind of went after his family in various ways. But really, everybody's saying this is because he's interested in running again in 2020.
And I think there was no way around that. I mean, I think he wound up basically, threading the needle in a way that was interesting on that because he, as you say, his brand has been the conscientious conservative, and he didn't say don't vote for Trump.
No.
And he did urge people to show up in November. He could arguably say in his own defense, look, I was just making sure that we don't lose people.
Yeah, and I would also say, honestly, what kind of gets lost in a lot of the discussion after this was, really all the focus was on, that one line. But the truth is, he actually gave a very good speech. I mean, before that, he had kind of gone into, at least if you're a conservative Republican voter, I mean, he had gone into hibernation since dropping out of the race for the most part, hadn't been doing a lot, hadn't been making a lot of public statements. And he came out and he actually, I said to you at the time, he'd actually taken a lot of the terms of progressivism and actually turn them in a way towards conservative principles in a very, I would say, if you're sort of previewing his 2020 run, you could actually see how he could use that language in a general election and still and be, certainly competitive with that kind of approach until this all happened. And then
let's talk about like that this all happened after. So let's go to the next. We have one more clip from that morning, which also, speaks to, this was also in response to a question from the audience that really does raise some of the criticism that Cruz was getting, that he had been one of the people that took the pledge, which is a kind of a big deal during the primary in many ways because of Trump, that he would support the ticket.
It's a funny quirk. I mean, we should point this out that, all the Republican candidates were basically asked, you pledge that you'll support the eventual Republican nominee. And the reason this pledge came up was because early in the primary, when Trump had a small but very committed set of primary voters, he had indicated that if he didn't win the primary, he was going to potentially, basically launch an independent bid because he has his own money.
If he didn't get a fair shake.
Yeah, if he didn't get a fair shake or whatever from the Republican establishment, he was going to run, basically have his own independent bid, which would surely have sunk any Republican chances in November. So they came up with this idea of this pledge, which everybody so wholeheartedly jumped onto, not thinking that Trump would actually become the nominee.
Right. So
this is what boxed Cruz in.
So let's listen to what Cruz says, the Senator Cruz says when asked about not keeping the pledge.
Well, thank you, ma'am. And thank you for speaking and speaking from your heart. I will tell you, when I stood on that debate stage and they asked every candidate there, if you don't win, will you support the nominee? I raised my hand and I raised my hand enthusiastically with full intention of doing exactly that. And I'll tell you the day that pledge was abrogated. The day that was abrogated was the day this became personal. And as I said at the time, and I'm not going to get into criticizing or attacking Donald Trump, but I'll just give you this response. I am not in the habit of supporting people who attack my wife and attack my father. And that pledge was not a blanket commitment that if you go and slander and attack Heidi, that I'm going to nonetheless come like a servile puppy dog and say thank you very much for maligning my wife and maligning my father.
I just have to add that puppy dogs are not servile. We won't have to, we'll just go from there. But otherwise, That is a telling kind of response from Cruz. And for somebody who wasn't going to attack and, wasn't upset, he starts yelling into the mic.
Right. He's a little upset.
Yeah. And, understandably so. So, Donald Trump.
Yeah. To wrap up this week, I mean, so remember, this happened on Wednesday night was Trump's, it was Cruz's speech. On Thursday morning, this was sort of Cruz's response. Thursday night was Trump's big night. He had his very, very long speech.
Right.
Acceptance speech. And then Friday morning, Cruz came up again.
Right. Cruz came up again at a press conference that, or at an event that, that Trump did with Mike Pence. And, you know, to set this in, you know, just briefly, I mean, this is kind of Trump's triumphant moment. It's the morning after he's accepted the Republican nomination. You know, he's going to run roughshod over a big field, and he's asked about Cruz, and this is his response.
I have to tell you, I think Heidi Cruz is a great person. I think it's the best thing he's got going in his kids, if you want to know the truth. I don't know his father. I met him once. I think he's a lovely guy. I think he's a lovely guy. All I did is point out the fact that on the cover of the National Enquirer, there was a picture of her, him and crazy Lee Harvey Oswald having breakfast. Now, Ted never denied that it was his father. This was a magazine that, frankly, in many respects, should be very respected. They got O.J., they got Edwards, they got this. I mean, if that was the New York Times, they would have gotten Pulitzer Prizes for their reporting. I know nothing about his father. I know nothing about Lee Harvey Oswald. But there was a picture on the front page of the National Enquirer, which does have credibility, and they're not going to do pictures like that because they get sued for a lot of money if things are wrong, okay? A lot of money. And there was a picture. And that's the only thing I know.
What to say about that?
Well, he's just defending himself, right?
You know, this is a man who likes to have the last word. But it also is emblematic of what the exchange between Trump and Cruz has been like, and one of the things that makes Donald Trump stand out in a way.
Well, it's emblematic of the Republican National Convention as a whole, right? You know, they had a series of you know, small to medium size, let's say, mishaps, or I mean, mishap isn't exactly the right word, but I mean, I guess you could say mishaps from the perspective of those organizing the convention.
Yeah, misfires, maybe.
Misfires,
is a way to
put it. Yeah. Whatever. You know, and usually what you're trying to do is you're trying to minimize the damage, minimize the coverage of it, and
right.
kind of, you know, put a lid on it.
Yeah.
But just as like a little, you know, Trump couldn't help himself but to bring it back up again.
Right. Just, yeah, just to, I guess to clarify that. In other words, you know, if you come out of the convention, you've been the nominee. The biggest negative story really has been how one of your candidates has not, one of your competitors has not endorsed you. The day before, you get the nomination, you move forward, and the last thing you want to be talking about, at least according to conventional wisdom, is Ted Cruz. And yet, the news that came out of that press conference was Trump talking about Ted Cruz with lots of people noticing how uncomfortable his vice presidential candidate looked behind him.
Right. So this led to, you know, basically the next set of questions is, well, you know, did the convention benefit Trump? Did it work in his favor? And what people are really looking to at this point is polling. Did he get what's called a convention bump? Usually candidates of both major parties after their convention see an uptick in their support in the public. Basically, you know, from things we talked about last week, they get an entire week where they theoretically get to dominate the media
right.
narrative on the one hand. So people who are sort of unfamiliar at the very least start to become familiar with them in a very controlled setting. But also it's, you know, a reminder to the partisan faithful, whether Republicans or Democrats, of why they're Republicans or why they're Democrats. So people who either haven't been paying attention or who maybe supported another candidate usually tend to greater or lesser degrees, come in line with the party and with the party candidate. So the question was, you know, there's basically this question following sort of the way that the Republican National Convention played out as to whether there would be a bump for the Republicans.
Right. So, you know, three or four polls went in the field, you know, immediately after and collected data after the convention. Most of those polls got rolled out then Monday morning to make the weekly, to make the news during the week. The results were a little mixed. Overall, it did look like Trump got something of a bounce. The biggest bounce and the one that was covered most widely, and that, of course, the Trump campaign has talked about the most, was the CNN poll. So between mid-June and the poll right after the convention, in mid-June, CNN had Clinton up by 7. In the post-convention poll, they had Trump up by 3. So you do the math, kind of a 10-point swing there. There was another poll by Morning Consult, more in the range of about a five point bounce. And then the CBS poll essentially showed no change, had Clinton and Trump tied in both. And I think there was an LA Times poll that I think also had a small bounce. So
It's about the 5 points we kind of expected if you were listening last week. You know,
yeah,
it's
the historic big bounces. I mean, I think in 88 is kind of one of the biggest ones in recent memories. Basically,
some people's recent memories.
Yeah, H.W. Bush got a plus taint, like between 10 and 12 point bounce, really big one. This kind of bounce seems to fall about with what you would expect. And what we also expect is that the Democrats will also get one and that neither will matter that much. And neither will, you know, the immediate post-convention polling almost never has any relationship to what happens in the general election.
Well, right. And there's something really important to make, you know, an important point to make here, which is that, you know, we don't have a national election. And right. So the fact is this is really early in the process. These are, you know, national polls. And, you know, how well these translate to the competitive states, because remember, most states are not going to be competitive come November. And amongst the subsets of states that actually are competitive, the battleground states, you know, those are all their own elections.
Right.
And the fact is they have their own set of sort of partisan and demographic characteristics. The campaigns are going to, be active in those states basically from now until Election Day. And really, you know, it's those sort of amalgamation of sort of state level attitudes that actually end up determining who wins the election in a lot of ways. So these national polls, you know, while it's going to give some sort of sense of what, you know, it will relate to the state polls, but it doesn't really tell us that much right now.
Right. Once we get past the conventions, there's two things, and we'll talk about this a lot. One, you need to follow the battleground polls, and two, you have to wait till it gets closer, and there'll be a lot of national polling, and really just trying to get some sense of that, where the country stands really comes from, you know, some way of processing all those polls together rather than any one poll, and particularly anything this early.
So let's turn back to Texas and Ted Cruz now.
Okay.
Too much fun.
So what do you want to say about Ted Cruz now?
Well, so in the same CNN poll, Cruz's favorable rating dropped among Republicans from 60% before his speech to 33% afterwards. So it's a 27-point drop. So, you know, this is sort of the instantaneous gut level reaction. Now, how much of this is real? You know, the fact is he just got a lot of negative coverage. And,
right.
And then, you know, they have to remember, most people aren't thinking a lot about Ted Cruz. I think about Ted Cruz a lot. You think about Ted Cruz a lot. But most people don't. And if you're...
We're different.
We're a little different. But if you're a Republican voter in, say, you know, Minnesota, right? And you don't think about Ted Cruz a lot, and you basically just watched, you know, 3 days of negative coverage on Fox News and really wherever else about Ted Cruz's, you know,
yeah, Ted Cruz's negative antics. Coverage transcended the usual ideological divide among
right.
network coverage.
And then you get called for a poll and they say, hey, what do you think of Ted Cruz? Well,
yeah,
you have a negative feeling. You know, that's not abnormal, but this is sort of interesting. I think, you know, there's this question of, you know, Ted Cruz 2020, you know, looking ahead, how does this work out for him in the long run, this decision? Because look,
right.
it's a regardless of the principle's part of it, but it's a political decision.
And for that matter, Ted Cruz 2018 in Texas, which is when he's up for re-election
right.
in the Senate. And I think, you know, every expectation or most expectations are that he will run for re-election for a Senate seat because he wants to run for president again in 2020 and he will want to run from the Senate.
He won't want to run after basically leaving office or losing. I mean,
right.
in some ways, there are advantages to not actually being in office and running. I mean, you can just totally focus on it. But what I think is interesting, this doesn't happen too often, but you and I kind of have opposite instant
yeah.
reactions to Cruz's move, you know, and whether this, you know, is going to work to his advantage in the long run or not. So why don't you do the work to his advantage?
I mean, I think it's predictable that for the reasons you talked about, he gets an immediate negative hit on this and people think he's a jackass and he's not. He's not getting on board with party unity. It would have been like, you know, to foreshadow, it would have been like Bernie Sanders not endorsing Hillary Clinton. Everybody would have thought he was really just being self-serving. On the other hand, you know, in this case, I think, you know, there is going to be, you know, some blowback about the Trump candidacy, particularly if he doesn't win, which is kind of the odds on bet right now. And I think the Cruz guys do the math and they play long term versus short term. And so you take a hit and there are some people that will never forget this. It's probably the people that, to my mind, are not inclined to support Ted Cruz now or later anyway. And if Donald Trump not only loses, but then loses badly and say the Republicans lose the Senate in the same election. You go and you blame everything on Donald Trump and you say, I told you so. And you do so in the tone that we were discussing earlier, which is, you know, Ted Cruz wants to be the conservative conscience and more practically the flag, the standard bearer for conservatives in the Republican Party and for seeing the Republican Party as an inherently conservative party. And so I think, while it's a gamble, I mean, it could be that this doesn't work out. It's a reasonable gamble.
Yeah, I think that all makes a ton of sense. And I agree with it, you know, generally. I think, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I think Ted Cruz, like most good politicians, is really, really aware of his brand. And his brand is this sort of conservative conscience and also this consistency. I mean, one of the things that we had talked about at various points, you know, throughout this election season is, you know, if Cruz were to win the nomination, would he pivot going into the general election, as candidates often do, pivot towards the middle to some degree because they've locked up their party's votes. And now you're looking to expand. And it's sort of hard to imagine how a Ted Cruz could pivot, you know, right, given his brand and everything. And in some ways, this is a consistency of that approach. And, you know, not being shackled by actually a general election, he's allowed to basically say, yeah, I'm still the conservative conscience of the party. You know, my initial reaction was, I don't know if this works out well for him in the long run, only because Cruz is sort of notable for how many enemies he's made in the Republican, you know, establishment. Now, maybe that doesn't matter. Right. I mean, obviously, there's sort of indications that maybe, you know, having this sort of elite, you know, consensus around you is not nearly as important as it used to be. And that's certainly the case, I think, this election cycle, at least on the right. But, you know, you could just see sort of, let's say, less cautious politicians after Cruz's speech, namely, you know, Chris Christie and New York's Peter King, a representative in the House, longtime representative in the House, basically flagging down cameras so they could, you know, excoriate Cruz right. in the sharpest terms.
Although not a new habit for either of those
guys. Not a new habit for either of those guys, but not in front of a national audience either.
Yeah.
And the truth is, you know, the one thing I was sort of was couching my, you know, is this a negative thing on Cruz? Is how many other, you know, how many other, let's say, Republican electeds take this chance to let people know how they really feel about Ted Cruz? Because yeah. remember, you know, in 2013, Ted Cruz did another sort of, you know, you could say stunt in a way, which is he shut down the government over the Affordable Care Act in a way that really rubbed, you know, let's say Republican leadership the wrong way because they sort of felt there was no plan behind it. And in the end,
it helped him.
It helped Cruz. It hurt Republicans yeah. nationally, but it helped Cruz.
Right.
And I think a lot of Republicans, you know, sort of see this, or at least Republican elites see this and say, you know, could see this as an opportunity to point out that Cruz isn't really in this for the Republican Party or the good of Republicans. He's in it for himself. And the you know, the going yeah. back on the pledge will, I think it will haunt him going forward. Will it have any effect? Probably not.
Well, I mean, I think it will. I mean, I think it will have an effect, but I mean, what is the longevity of that effect?
Well, and in his right. electoral fortune. Well, I mean, that's why I think the comments are so important in the sense that now you've got, you know, basically Republican statewide on camera that any, you know, basically saying what a liar Ted Cruz is and how he says he's so principled and he's not. And that exists for eternity and exists for, and by eternity, yeah. I mean, for every campaign ad of everybody.
Well, they're not, yeah, I mean, you just misspoke there. They're not Republican statewides, but Republican leaders. But I think there's the rub in some ways. You know, Peter King may still be around. Chris Christie's pretty much done.
Yeah. No, so. Like I said, I couch it all and it depends on who else joins the bandwagon. It looks like right. most people are being more cautious.
And, you know, people do have, you know, people make, people can be really mad at Ted Cruz, but if it, and really even dislike him, but if it works to, you know, in a couple of years to make up, I think a lot of them will. And, you know, even if they're, you know, waiting for the opportunity to stab him in the back later on. In the short run, there has been lots of talk about, or it's led to little blips in terms of Cruz. You know, Joaquin Castro, one of the telegenic Castro brothers that are seen as the among the leading future prospects among Texas Democrats, you know, sending up trial balloons today about running against him in Texas in 2018.
And there's some interest in funding a primary challenger to
right. Trump making, you know, noise about funding a super PAC, you know, to primary him in Texas in 2018.
Yeah, and even some more establishment minded Republicans are talking about.
Yeah. So there's, you know, there's something to your position. I don't think either of those things are much of a threat to Ted Cruz, and particularly Donald Trump actually spending the kind of money he was talking about. But we'll see. So before we run just extremely long, let's turn a little bit to the Democratic Convention. And we'll talk more about the Democratic Convention next week, like we talked more about the Republican Convention this week, since, you know, we still, as of this recording, haven't heard from Bill Clinton, haven't heard from Hillary Clinton, haven't heard from a lot of people yet. But on opening night, Democrats had a pretty eventful, but I think ultimately successful opening night last night. You know, the real key last night, I think, you know, the two storylines, one during the day and going into it, how would the Bernie Sanders supporters behave at the convention? Could they be brought on board? And the, you know, it was a rough weekend and start to the day. There was a release of all these emails illustrating, you can't even say suggesting, illustrating how a lot of the formal party organization at the Democratic National Committee heavily favored Hillary Clinton and did not, you know, appreciate, shall we say, Bernie Sanders. And, you know, those emails came out re-inflamed already kind of boisterous and dissatisfied Sanders supporters, led to the resignation as kind of the lead story going into the convention of DNC chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz from Florida. That kind of sets the stage for the convention taking off, or actually getting off to a start during the day yesterday. The news coverage really was all, you know, people booing the speakers and the Sanders folks.
Well, and in particular, protesting. Bernie Sanders himself getting booed, yeah, when mentioning Hillary Clinton at some gathering
of his supporters. Right. Yeah, and he was clearly trying to smooth the way. I mean, the stories today came out that there have been lots of back channel communication between Sanders' campaign, Democratic officials, in which the Sanders people were acknowledging that their people might get out of hand and they would try to smooth it. Yeah, Sanders tries to do that. You know, mentions that people have to get behind Hillary Clinton. He gets roundly booed by his own folks. Which, if you watch the video, you can see he's kind of taken aback. He's kind of like, you know, right, this is the world we live in, brothers and sisters, I think was the quote.
So that was the context going into the evening. So right, Everybody was pretty much ready for it to be a bit of a mess in some
ways. And it was a little messy, though. You could hear, if you were watching the televised coverage, you could hear what were probably small, but certainly vocal groups of Sanders supporters booing when Hillary Clinton was mentioned and chanting various things. You know, it got a little better as some of the speakers developed without doing a blow-by-blow. But what really turned the tide was when Michelle Obama spoke. And if, you know, any of you have watched the media coverage since then, you know, that became the story, was really how forceful and how effective Michelle Obama was in both making the case for Hillary Clinton, talking personally about her experience that kind of galvanized people's views, and also really, you know, making, you know, dinging Donald Trump without mentioning his name. So let's play an excerpt of Michelle Obama.
But here's the thing. What I admire most about Hillary is that she never buckles under pressure. She never takes the easy way out. And Hillary Clinton has never quit on anything in her life. And when I think about the kind of president that I want for my girls and all our children, that's what I want. I want someone with the proven strength to persevere, someone who knows this job and takes it seriously. Someone who understands that the issues a president faces are not black and white and cannot be boiled down to 140 characters. Look, because when you have the nuclear codes at your fingertips and the military in your command, you can't make snap decisions. You can't have a thin skin or a tendency to lash out. You need to be steady and measured and well-informed.
So that really encapsulates in that 90-second or so excerpt kind of everything I think she accomplished in that speech. There's a strong personal element about, you know, what she wants for her and her girls. And there was a big theme last night about family and parenthood, mm-hmm, and girls, I think, actually, you know, makes the case for, you know, why Hillary Clinton is a good candidate. dings Trump with the thin skin and the Twitter comment, and then also introduces just how high the stakes are to wrap it all up. You know, pretty good speech writing and pretty amazing delivery when you come right down to it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I think, you know, again, you can go and there's a million places you can read, you know, sort of analysis of why and how she did so well. But one of the things that I think that she did was, you know, she was able to do something that nobody else has sort of done so far, which is she tied this sort of narrative thread between, you know, President Obama's historic candidacy and presidency to Hillary Clinton, but without tying her to his agenda.
Right.
And she did that very, very carefully. And so, I mean, people are basically saying, now this is one of the best, you know, DNC speeches of all time. It's up there on the list of, you know, whatever top speeches. And so, you know, she basically just subsumed all coverage in a lot of ways. The whole day's coverage was this discord between Bernie supporters and the Clinton, you know, basically in Clinton. And then Michelle came in and it just became about what a great speech that was, which is sort of an interesting sort of look into sort of, and I guess how the media operates and, you know, how conventions get covered in some ways.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that, and I think it was done in a very strategically sound way by the people behind
this. Right, because originally, I think Sanders was going to actually open up at the primetime hour, and then Michelle was going to come later, and they flipped it during the day, which, pretty good decision, it turned
out. Well, and they flipped it in a way that sent the signal that they were actually giving Sanders pride of place.
Right.
Even though ultimately it was Michelle Obama being prior to Sanders, I think, really helped. And there were some other people that did a pretty good job in there of smoothing out the crowd. You know, I mean, I think Paul Simon's, you know, raspy bridge over troubled water and the Al Franken, Sarah Silverman thing with where Sarah Silverman kind of now very famously admonished the Sanders supporters about their behavior in the hall.
Cory Booker yelling over protesters, basically.
Exactly. So all of that did set up Bernie Sanders. And Sanders, you know, I think also did a not as flamboyant job. There were parts of the Sanders speech very familiar, but I mean, he accomplished a lot in addressing the hall and addressing in particular his supporters. I think you put it well, giving them the chance for a little bit of catharsis by playing a kind of Bernie Sanders greatest hits in terms of about Wall Street and Citizens United, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, the first two thirds of his speech in a lot of ways, I mean, you could have said, wait, is he the nominee?
Right.
I mean, and that was the point, right? It gave his people the chance to sort of have that feeling that he was getting that spot, that, you know, sort of in prime time.
Right.
And that if he were the nominee, this is what the speech would look like. And, you know, I think that probably...
But he did a very good job, though, then of doing that and then saying, and tying that to, you know, saying essentially, you know, we got a lot here because we've, all these things, we've affected the platform. Mm-hmm. And Hillary Clinton supports these things, too. And that's why we should all, you know, come together and support her. So let's just play. This is basically the last, this is again the wind up. This is the wind up of Sanders' speech, about the last 90 seconds.
Our job now is to see that strong Democratic platform implemented by a Democratic controlled Senate, by a Democratic House, and a Hillary Clinton presidency. And I am going to do all that I can to make that happen. I have known Hillary Clinton for 25 years. I remember her, as you do, as a great first lady who broke precedent in terms of the role that a first lady was supposed to play as she helped lead the fight for universal health care. I served with her in the United States Senate and know her as a fierce advocate for the rights of children, for women, and for the disabled. Hillary Clinton will make an outstanding president, and I am proud to stand with her tonight. Thank you all very much.
So that does what he is expected to do. It's in some ways a pretty stark contrast, shall we say, with Ted Cruz. And it sets the stage for the rest of the convention. So we'll come back next week. We'll see whether the Democrats get a bounce,
how it looks compared to whether they unify.
We'll see, you know, if last night really let off enough pressure, if you will, for the convention, for Hillary Clinton to unify the party behind her candidacy. So encourage you to keep an eye on those things, and we'll talk to you next week. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project and the Project 2021 Development Studio at the University of Texas at Austin.